My name is Eden Robinson. My father is Heisla. My mother is Heltzik. My father was he was a young man at a time when there were still arranged marriages in the village. And the woman he was supposed to be marrying thought he was a bit shiftless. He was a commercial fisherman and a basketball player, which meant that he had a lot of dates and a lot of opportunity for dating. So she married someone else. And so my grandmother, my maternal grandmother, decided that Dad was becoming embarrassing. He was a very old man. He was 33 and still unmarried. So she took it upon herself to campaign through the village for a wife for him. My father's response to this was to go fishing. So he left the summer he was supposed to get engaged to another woman, and he went to down south to Area 8, which is, it's about 250 miles south of Kitimat on the coast, and he was on a seiner called the Helicula, which is actually, the Hecula, which is a Norwegian word. I can't remember what it's for, but he has many stories about the Hecula. It was the crankiest boat on the face of the planet. It had been built wrong. If you have ever read Christine by Stephen King, the Hecula was much like Christine, and eventually it had a tragic end and pulled people down, but it wasn't my father. At this point, the Hecula broke down, and they were in Bella Bella for repairs. My mother had just returned from the States. She went to residential school for a few years, and then she met a missionary couple who had just come back from Uganda. They'd been chased out by Idi Amin, and they were coming up the coast on the ferry, and they met my mother and her brother, and they were so taken by them that they asked her if, instead of going to residential school, would she like to go down to the States with them to Eugene, Oregon, to spend a year on their farm. And they were dentists, so my mother had sparkling teeth by the end of the year. She had very, very spotty dental care. But when she came back, she had Hollywood teeth, and she had deep auburn hair. And one of her big dreams in life was to be an actress, and she especially loved the theater. But there weren't a lot of opportunities in Bella Bella in the late 50s, early 60s, and she found it quite stifling because her mother kept having babies, and she was expected to do a lot of the babysitting. So on the weekend, she would go out to a jukebox joint. And meanwhile, my father had landed at the dock, and him and his fishing buddies went to a nearby bar and got extremely drunk. There was no ramp. There was a gangplank, just a sort of 2x4, so leading down to the dock. So they were staggering down to their boat when my mother, who was living on a boathouse with her mother, looked out and saw him and said, "That's the man I'm going to marry." Her version of this is a little different. This is actually Gran's version. I think Mom's version was that he looks really cute or he's hot. That version of it. But if you've seen pictures of my father when he was young, he was quite striking And there were many women in Bella Bella who wanted, oh, please come in, who wanted to date him. So when he went to the jukebox joint and saw my mother, the attraction was there, and they danced. And they danced quite late. They didn't really talk. But my mother lost track of the time. And in Bella Bella, at that point, there was a curfew. So at 11 o'clock, all the lights went out. The generator switched off. And if you were trying to get home, it was very difficult, especially if you're like my mother and she really liked her heels. So my father offered to walk her home, and they kissed, and they had a very traditional sort of engagement. They shacked up for 6 months, and then they decided to get married. So by this time, my mother's family quite liked my father, but my father wanted to move back to Kitimat. And they got married in Bella Bella, and then they decided to have the reception in Kitimat. And they went home, and my grandmother was not very pleased because she'd already arranged a different relationship for my father, and this was making things awkward. So she graciously gave my mother a potlatch name so my mother could attend the potlatches in Kitimat Village. And the name she chose was Monster Rising from the Sea. And they had my parents lived with my grandparents for, I believe it was a year before my father built a house for my mother. And she was, she had my brother, my older brother, and then 3 years later she had me, and they decided to stop there because they had a boy and they had a girl. And then my sister came, and we lived in Kitimat until 1974, and then we moved down to Bella Bella and lived there for about 4 years, and then we moved back to Kitimat. And from there on, I spent a majority of my life in Kitimat Village, or Kitimat the town, which is 11 kilometers away. And I always had a very strong sense of what it meant to be Haisla. And when I even attempted to forget, my aunties would whack me upside the head and go, "Don't you forget who you are." So that I had a very ingrained sense of what was proper and not proper behavior for a young lady. And but in my defense, my parents had never actually been ladies or gentlemen, so my role models were very free-spirited. And but Kitimat is quite small, and being 18, I was dying to get out. So I spent I did my bachelor's and did my master's, and I went through all the sort of all the build up to writing a novel. And my very first novel, I had a choice to set it in Kitimat Village, where it was in my mind, or to set it in a place that I made up. And I can understand why authors don't set their pieces in their own hometowns. It's quite harrowing to it's intimidating to have that much responsibility to fairly write about a place, especially from the village where no one had written There had been a couple of ethnographers in the 30s and 40s who'd written about Kitimat Village, and they'd written about it so disparagingly, and with so much bias that for years after, anyone who was writing about the village was instantly regarded with suspicion. When I started writing Monkey Beach, I originally didn't want to set it in Kitimat Village. I wanted to make up a place so I'd be free of those responsibilities, so I could just concentrate on the material, because by then I hadn't really written a novel and I didn't really know how to do that. I was still grasping plot, and I didn't really want to deal with all the politics that went with it. But I quickly realized that once I set the novel outside of Kitimat Village, it lost its power, it lost the voice, it lost the energy that made it alive, because the place was so important to what I was writing that if I didn't set it there, it wasn't going to work. So I committed to having Monkey Beach set in Kitimat Village, and decided to do a research trip. This was 1992, and I had 2 weeks off from one of my jobs, so I took a seat sail back to the village, and I was sort of a surprise visitor, and my father at this point was 66 and he was still working, so he only had a limited time to take me out to Monkey Beach. And so he took me out the first time, and I heard about a Haisla heritage camp, which was there's a group of people, it was a combination of environmentalists and activists who were putting together camps to bring together elders from different communities and children and youth in two separate camps. This must have been earlier. I can't remember. When did Wayne's World come out? what year was that? Oh, it was 92. Okay, I got it right then. I vividly remember that because the next week I went out with the Haisla Heritage Camp that had 16-year-old boys. And every night we'd go down to the lake and we'd have a cultural sharing. We would all sit around the fire and tell stories. And the only stories they wanted to tell were Wayne's World. So they would reenact scenes from Wayne's World. So this happened every night that I was there, and it was yes. If you really want, I can recite the scenes for you. But this was quite an eye-opening trip for me. It was I had never been to the Kitlope. I had never been camping on the lake in any form. The Haisla there were three branches of the Haisla. There were the Hanaxila, who were from that area. They were Kitlope. There was Haisla. They were at the bottom of this very long river, and basically the real name for Haisla actually meant the people at the bottom of the river. And then the Nalabila, which meant the people at the top of the river. Very practical with their names. The bay is the bay, the chuck is the chuck. And the elders that I met, I had never really spoken to in any great detail. And it was a life-altering moment for me. They spoke of the place as a living being, and they spoke of the water, and they spoke of the animals in ways I'd never really understood until I was there. experiencing it. And the Kitlope is one of the largest untouched watersheds in British Columbia. And it's hard to imagine being in an untouched forest until you've actually been there. There was some minor logging at the bottom of the Kamano River, and there is the hydroelectric dam, but once you're on the river, once you're up in the lake, it's the wilderness is just it's a tangible presence, and I don't think Monkey Beach would be the book it was if I hadn't been out there for the week. And there was also at that time an ethnobotanist named Allison, and she was my age, and we'd both been going to the University of Victoria, and we became quite good friends. And she was writing a book called Salmonberry Blossoms in the Spring. And at the end of the summer, she was working quite closely with an elder named B. Wilson. And I found it very disturbing that winter that they had published Salmonberry Blossoms in the Spring through EcoTrust, and there were objections in the village to having such sensitive material published. It was mostly plants, but there were some stories mixed in there, and some of the stories were family stories, which means that they weren't for public consumption. It was a breach of protocol. So there were these lovely books with a lot of valuable information that were warehoused because they contained stories that belonged to families. In Heisler copyright, to have permission to publish those stories, you'd have to throw a potlatch. And for the five or six pieces that they had, that would be five or six separate potlatches, which would have run them a good $70,000 to $100,000. So I have a copy of Salmonberry, and lots of people in the village have copies, but it's not available for public consumption. So all this was in my head when I was writing Monkey Beach. So I was very, very, very aware of what I could and could not write. And I took it extremely seriously because I wanted to go back home. And I wanted my parents not to be embarrassed by me. And at the same time, I didn't want to pull back. I didn't want to say things that weren't true. It was a very difficult point because I was entering the final draft of Monkey Beach, and I didn't really know what to do, so I just started asking my aunties and my uncles and my cousins, and I would show them drafts of Monkey Beach, which is not something I regularly do. They weren't trained writers, but they were trained in the traditional knowledge. And there were parts of the book that were inaccurate. When you're small and you're growing up and you absorb the culture, sort of half listening to it, half not, your brain starts to fill in the patterns. And I had assumed some things were true because I remembered them that way. But when I started speaking to people, they would very gently correct me and tell me, this is not exactly how it works, you know. I'll tell you a story. And then they'd tell me a story, and I could see where I was veering off path. At the same time, it was one of the most... it was the first time I had been very timid about approaching people and asking them for help. And what I discovered was that people are actually very willing to help you, and they're very willing to come forward with their knowledge. And if you listen to them, they're more than willing to give you their lives. And it was... It was just wonderful. So Monkey Beach became a very, very positive experience. And I don't think I would have had as deep an experience without the salmonberry blossoms in the spring. And it was just, I couldn't have connected the way I did.